In the coming week, the U.S. sets in motion a complete withdrawal from Afghanistan. 40 world leaders are invited to a U.S.-led climate summit, and Japanese Prime Minister Suga meets with President Biden at the White House. It's April 15th, 2021, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, yesterday President Biden announced the United States will be withdrawing from Afghanistan in total by September 11th, which is the 20th anniversary of the attacks carried out by al-Qaeda leaders who were given safe haven by the Taliban. In addition, peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban have been postponed to at least April 24th. Jim, can you give us a sense now of the state of play in the region and what this U.S. drawdown may be precipitating?
Certainly, Bob. With U.S. troops set to be out of Afghanistan in less than 5 months, we're looking at a very different future for that landlocked country. Again, the United States invaded Afghanistan back in 2001, seeking to track down Osama bin Laden and other elements of al-Qaeda. I don't think anybody at that time imagined the United States would still be there nearly 20 years later. I note that the U.S. military is now recruiting people who were not born to 2 or 3 years after the September 11th attacks. And I think that was one of the motivating drivers in President Biden's decision that we've been there long enough, done what we can. It is time to sort of readjust our military portfolio around the world, given other challenges we face. I will note, as President Biden mentioned in his prepared remarks yesterday, that President Trump had agreed in a deal with the Taliban that U.S. troops would be out of Afghanistan by May 1, which is just about 2 weeks from now. We're not going to meet that deadline. And the Taliban have already signaled that they may up their attacks in Afghanistan in light of the fact that the United States hasn't left. I should also note, not only are U.S. troops leaving, but so are NATO troops that are there. There are actually more NATO troops in Afghanistan than U.S. troops. And then the big question is going to be, what comes next? And here you hear different pictures from different experts. Many people are warning that with the U.S. withdrawal, we're going to see the Taliban relatively quickly come to power in Afghanistan. They'll note that the Taliban already holds substantial tracts of land in Afghanistan as things now stand. And these experts paint a very dire picture of the future of Afghanistan. I hear a lot of talk about what is likely to happen when the Taliban comes to power and what it will mean for women in Afghanistan. You'll be hearing and seeing a lot of articles comparing that future to something that happened 46 years ago, the fall of Saigon. Now, other experts say that vision is overblown. Either they will emphasize that this Taliban is different than the Taliban of 2 decades ago, that they have different ambitions, they're more limited, they understand that they need to have international support and financing coming in, so you're not going to see the draconian, and that's maybe a polite way of describing the rule of the Taliban 2 decades ago. And these experts will argue that either other elements of Afghan society will mobilize to counter the Taliban, or that neighboring countries, think Pakistan, think China, think Iran, will have a stake in preventing the Taliban from gaining full control over the country. Time will tell whether which, if either of those two visions of Afghanistan's future are going to come to fruition.
Yeah, Jim, that really kind of sums it up. I think no matter when this decision was made, now or 5 years from now, or 5 years ago for that matter, it was going to be a wrenching one because of the amount of, for one thing, blood and treasure committed by the U.S. to this campaign, but also that it had seemingly long superseded the initial goal of ousting a terror threat and had become a nation-building enterprise that, as it has rolled along, has gained an amount of U.S. commitment that seemingly it could not sort of extricate itself from. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this scenario plays out. It's, on the one hand, there feels like this inevitability of a Taliban coming back and being, if not in total control, then being an extremely powerful power broker in a future Afghanistan. At the same time, it does feel like the country has moved on in some ways remarkably from the country we saw just on the eve of the 9/11 attacks, which was this completely isolated, almost medieval country led mostly by the Taliban with a strict interpretation of Sharia law. You know, the country that had bombarded these famous Buddhist relics, that had stadiums filled with people watching the stoning of women and all the other barbarities that people may recall, that country, it doesn't exist anymore. So it is going to be very interesting to see what other dynamics take hold, whether Afghans in and of themselves are going to be able to come up with something different that maybe hasn't been raised in a lot of the back and forth of the last few days.
You're right, Bob. And I think a lot of the debate here at home turns on the question of what does the United States owe Afghanistan? And people who argue for sustaining a U.S. military role in Afghanistan essentially argue that with relatively small investment of blood and treasure, that we could prevent the Taliban from coming to power, and that by doing so, we limit the risk of a repeat of what we saw before 9/11, which was Al-Qaeda planning attacks on the United States. Moreover, we have an obligation because we have engaged in this nation-building exercise to try to protect the investment of the last 20 years, and particularly a great deal of concern about women and the role of women in Afghanistan, and we owe them something. On the flip side, you have the argument, which is that the United States has been there for 20 years. What we've discovered is that despite our immense military power, we cannot remake societies. And you might think that American history has shown us that a number of times. The failure in Iraq, we can go back to the beginning of the 20th century with interventions throughout the Caribbean, places like Nicaragua, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and the like. Our track record of sort of recreating societies isn't that great. But moreover, the argument would be that the United States has other priorities and that the challenge posed by terrorism is not geographically based. And indeed, if you look at 9/11, while the plot may have been authorized by Osama bin Laden in the mountains of Afghanistan, it was actually planned in Germany and carried out by terrorists who went to flight school in the United States. And indeed, over the last two decades, the terrorist threat has metastasized, and you can see it in Northern Africa. We've talked a lot about the Sahel, East Africa, problems in Asia. So the argument is it's not clear why we need to stay in Afghanistan. And what we're going to do, and I think this is the Biden plan, is that we will address the terrorism threat from Afghanistan by being offshore. We'll use drones, we'll use planes, and the like. And then you get into an argument as to how effective that will be, whether you can have sufficient intelligence and the like. And again, a big unknown here is what are the other countries who have a stake in where Afghanistan goes? What do they do? Who do they support? And again, you know, experts can argue this back and forth.
Yeah, I think that last part in particular is a very good point, particularly again, when if Afghanistan enters this period, which unfortunately is a possibility of, you know, sort of one atrocious attack or, you know, some sort of movement against civilians or some movement against women in which there many people are killed or atrocities are committed, there's going to be this tendency like, well, what's the U.S. going to do about it? And it's going to be more like, well, what is the world prepared to do about this that can have any sort of meaningful impact? And that's going to be regional. It's going to be other powers, as well as the U.S. trying to rally some sort of response. And again, in the previous iteration of Taliban rule, you know, 20 plus years ago, it was basically drawing a cordon around the country, and there wasn't much left to sanction by the time the 9/11 attacks came around. So we'll have to see how this plays out, Jim.
I will also note, Bob, that there is a significant political risk here for President Biden, obviously, if a terrorist attack does occur. And again, I will note that the decision has split members of the military. I can find U.S. generals and admirals saying that it's about time that we get out of Afghanistan. And I can find military officers who say we should still stay there. We have an obligation and a national interest to be there. But it's also splitting people politically. Now, remember, President Trump came to office saying that he wanted to get out of Afghanistan. He negotiated an agreement saying we would be out of Afghanistan by this coming May 1st. But there are plenty of Democrats, plenty of Republicans who think it's a really bad idea, perhaps none more forcefully articulated in that point of view than Lindsey Graham, who said yesterday, and let me quote him here, "A full withdrawal from Afghanistan is dumber than dirt and devilishly dangerous. President Biden will have, in essence, canceled an insurance policy against another 9/11. And so I think that's something to pay attention to as we go forward, because at least here in official Washington, there's a great deal of division over the wisdom of getting out. I think if you look at public opinion polls, most Americans want to be done with Afghanistan.
And on that latter point, it was one of of the few areas where you had candidate Biden pretty much in agreement with President Trump in terms of making moves sooner rather than later to end the so-called forever wars the U.S. was engaged in.
Certainly was the case, Bob. But let's shift gears. In the coming week, President Biden plans to mark Earth Day with a virtual climate summit that will bring together some 40 world leaders to underscore both the urgency and the economic benefits of stronger climate action. The Biden administration has invited not only the leaders of the major economies forum on energy and climate, but also the heads of countries that are especially vulnerable to climate impacts or are demonstrating strong climate leadership. So tell us a bit more, Bob, about this Earth Day Climate Summit.
Well, Jim, a number of things, but I think first and foremost, it's about pumping life and sort of real action back into the Paris Accord. You'll recall one of the first things that President Biden did in taking office was to return the U.S. back into the Paris Agreement, the 2015 agreement that was entered into by President Obama and that President Trump pulled the U.S. out of in fairly short order. And so this agreement, getting into some of the details, the agreement is aimed at keeping global average temperature from rising 1.5 degrees Celsius or just less than 3 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. And if not, then preventing it from reaching at least 2. Now, according to a number of estimates, the world has already hit 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming. So a lot remains to be done. And a lot of the goals that were set are sort of trickling along in slow motion. We're hearing every year now of more and more extreme climate events, polar ice cap melting. The nations that are invited to this summit from some island states and those with serious, water table rising issues are going to be making that point loud and clear that the future is now and that the U.S. and the Biden administration are going to try to make an emphatic gesture to be front and center in leading the effort to take meaningful action. So the U.S. standing in agreement, what does that mean? It means the U.S. actually going out and making strong commitment to cutting emissions. I've seen some estimates that it's going to lay out either just before the summit or at the summit a goal to cut emissions by 50% by 2030. So that's only 9 years away and a whole host of efforts to try to bring that about. And that includes marshaling the private sector and reaching out to them. It includes all sorts of ramping up all sorts of green energy initiatives to get more and more people to use renewables and energies that are not based on fossil fuels, and then getting other countries to rally behind that. So at a time when the foreign policy agenda is ever more crowded in the U.S. and there will be some countries that were invited that are at very sharp cross purposes with the U.S., the Biden administration is trying to make a major gesture on the climate front, Jim.
Well, there are two things to flag there, Bob. One is you mentioned that President Biden is going to commit himself to some ambitious goals in climate. Of course, that ties into his infrastructure bill, which seems to have some uncertain future, given that at least some moderate Democrats are unhappy with aspects of it. And it clearly has some opposition from Republicans. But it's going to be interesting to see over the next several months whether Biden can actually go beyond sort of putting down goals and actually getting Congress to pass programs that allow him to achieve those goals. But there's also the issue, as we're chatting here right now, that his climate czar, John Kerry, the former Secretary of State, is in Shanghai meeting with Chinese counterparts. Can you tell us a little bit about what those discussions may look like and be about?
Yeah, so I think somewhat akin to the talks that the U.S. had with China prior to the Paris Accord. It was late 2014, I believe, when the U.S. and China came out with an agreement that they would, that these two largest emitting countries in the world had agreed on volunteer targets on cutting emissions, I think at the time by the year 2050. And that at the time was the first sort of pledge of its type. And then that created this momentum that really continued right up and through the Paris Accord. So I think it's continued to be an area, despite many, many complications and antagonisms that had developed in that time period between the United States and China, climate does seem to be an area where there's traction. It was even reported at the fairly rancorous meeting in Alaska between top officials from both countries that climate was one of the few areas where there was some sort of common cause agreement that the countries could maybe help and sort of lead the way. So again, the two countries, these two largest economies in the world, two biggest emitters in the world, if they can come up with some sort of commitment, again, these are commitments to sort of volunteering their countries to reach targets. But if they could do that, if Kerry can come from China with some sort of agreement, some sort of a pledge from China, that the thinking is that creates a great deal of momentum going into the summit. And then the details can sort of be worked out later. The blueprint for, at least for the U.S., for example, or for the globe, for that matter, can sort of be sorted out. And there could be some kind of further momentum running up to the year-end meeting that countries are supposed to be taking stock of the Paris commitment. So I think I haven't seen anything concrete out of the Shanghai meeting yet, Jim, but I think we should watch it really closely because I think that there's very much an intention to try to create some wind in the sails for the summit coming out of this set of talks.
But how optimistic should we be, Bob, about the potential for this meeting in Shanghai to produce real progress as opposed to notional progress? Again, it's very easy to set goals, particularly when the goals aren't to be achieved for 20, 30, 40 years, because I will note that U.S.-China relations right now are tense and getting tenser. And the Chinese, while on the one hand talking about the importance of moving to a carbon neutral world, are also through their Belt and Road Initiative funding the construction of hundreds of coal-fired power plants that will exacerbate the problems we have with climate change. So is there any reason to believe that the Chinese are committed to moving ahead, particularly when they can turn and point and say, number one, the United States historically has contributed more heat-trapping gases to the world than China has. And given that the Chinese at this point don't seem to want to cut any breaks for the United States.
Well, it's a really good point, Jim. And given all you just said, it does seem like it's a steep hill for Kerry to climb for the administration, at least in the run-up to the summit. Do the Chinese feel strongly enough about this issue to help create a win for the Biden administration at the same time when it's pressing all sorts of other initiatives against China, calling it out for behavior in Xinjiang, rebuking it for actions in Hong Kong, et cetera, and also coming up against it in terms of increasing tensions in the South China Sea and Taiwan and so forth? So is there enough enlightened self-interest for China to say, yes, we're down with this. Let's create something that can make this Biden summit successful. It does seem a bit dubious. I will say that the Chinese, you know, your point's well taken about the Belt and Road Initiative and the enormous sort of outlay for coal plant production and coal emissions and so forth. The Chinese seem to be covering a lot of bets because they also are a country investing enormous amounts of money in renewables. And they are actually, the world kind of relies on the Chinese in some cases for things like solar panels. And they do a lot in terms of solar and wind production. Their high-tech investment continues to be enormous. The Chinese always have an eye to the future, but they're going to move at their own pace at the same time, Jim. So again, that's what creates one of the biggest question marks about this. I don't think John Kerry would have made this trip if they didn't think there was some deliverable from it. He's reportedly talking to some interlocutors with whom he is well familiar in the Chinese government who are involved in these issues. And so there's a sense that there might be something, and maybe it's at the end of the day, a more modest agreement, but anything at this point is seen as important as, again, the administration tries to get climate raised as a priority issue for the world amidst all the other problems. And oh, by the way, in the midst of a pandemic.
I still think the Chinese are going to come back and say the United States needs to do more, and that'll be their talking point. And they will claim they're doing a lot.
Yeah. And so I think the administration needs to be prepared to come up with its own goals and maybe try to, you know, encourage a race to the top, so to speak, in terms of what it's preparing to do. There are some easier steps it can take, like, you know, re-upping the money that the Obama administration had pledged for the UN's Green Climate Fund and things of that nature. But the summit's taking place on Earth Day. It's a very aspirational moment. And so we'll just have to see, you know, what meaningful emerges from this, Jim. And I should note, Jim, that the summit is virtual, that countries are signing on to attend virtually, but the U.S. is the sort of convening a nation for all of that. But let me talk about some more Asian diplomacy that's taking place in person. And this is the visit to Washington of Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga. On April 16th, that's tomorrow, President Biden and Prime Minister Suga are scheduled to meet at the White House, and they're expected to talk about China, about Taiwan, and about climate issues. Jim, can you tell us a bit more about what they're going to be talking about and maybe agreeing on?
Happy to, Bob. I think if you look at this summit meeting, and this will be the first foreign head of state that President Biden will be receiving in person at the White House, it is the flip side of where we began our conversation with Afghanistan. The Biden administration has said from the get-go that China is job one and that we need to focus our attention away from places like the Middle East and think big and think hard about our relations with China, but also our relations with our friends and allies. And obviously, Japan, a treaty ally, a country since it is in East Asia, has a real stake in the future of the U.S.-China relationship and where it goes. So this is high-stakes diplomacy. And as your question intimated, the White House clearly wants this meeting to end with a full-throated statement of Japanese support for the idea of taking a tough line in dealing with the Chinese. Now, there's been a lot of speculation in the press and run-up to the meeting as to whether the Chinese are going to sign on respond to the statement that the White House wants. I think a lot of that is about specific terminology. But obviously, the Japanese have a vested interest, but they're also in a difficult position. So let's keep in mind that Japan's security guarantor is clearly the United States. So obviously, for Tokyo, maintaining good and close relations with the United States is its job one. And indeed, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Prime Minister Suga's predecessor, clearly went out of his way during the Trump administration to make sure no daylight opened up between Tokyo and Washington, even as President Trump would be critical of things like Tokyo's supposed lack of contributions to basing U.S. troops in Japan and attacking trade agreements and the rest. The flip side is that China is Japan's number one trading partner. They sell a lot of stuff to the Chinese. They also need a lot of stuff that comes from China. And the Chinese, as we know, in the last couple of years, has not been shy about baring its teeth, flashing its ability to coerce others through its economic ties. And we've seen some of this even in the run-up to this particular meeting. Obviously, Beijing is paying very close attention to what it is that's going to be happening at the White House tomorrow. And if I could draw a baseball analogy, since Major League Baseball has resumed, some of the statements coming out of the Chinese foreign ministry are akin to a high fastball, high and tight, to sort of back the batter off the plate. And I think the Chinese have been trying to warn Japan that they could be putting bilateral Chinese-Japanese relations in a tough spot. Now, I do think we're going to come out of this meeting with a joint statement that is about the importance of standing up for free, open Indo-Pacific. Again, Japan is part of the so-called Quad with Australia, the United States, and India. So this is not a sort of a new departure in relations. But I think you're going to have a lot of experts parsing the exact words on that score. But I should also note, there's also a big political dimension here, more so for Prime Minister Suga than for President Biden. Obviously, for President Biden, wants to show that he is able to enlist America's friends and allies in dealing with the China challenge. But even more so for Prime Minister Suga, because Japan is going to have parliamentary elections sometime between now and October of this year. And Prime Minister Suga is in a rather unusual position for a Japanese prime minister. Typically, if you look at the Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, which has been the dominant party for most of Japan's post-war experience, prime ministers are people who head up one of the powerful factions within the LDP. Prime Minister Suga doesn't have that kind of institutional support. And so you'll hear some people argue that actually he's a fairly weak prime minister who is, you know, trying to deal with sort of navigating and building a coalition among factions who were themselves looking to find ways to get their person in charge. A lot of people say, well, you know, that's a real testament to Prime Minister Suga that he becomes prime minister without actually having the backing of a significant faction in the party. But clearly, he's in an election, and many Japanese are unhappy with his handling of COVID. Though again, if you were to compare Japanese numbers with American numbers, you would think the Japanese have done remarkably well. I think many Japanese have a different perspective on that. But so he's in a difficult position, and he, again, needs to come out of this meeting showing that he has a good relationship with Joe Biden and with the United States, but also to do so in a way that doesn't trigger economic pressure from China. And again, the Chinese, not only economically, but could create problems for the Japanese in the military sphere, the so-called Senkaku Diaoyu Islands, which are disputed. And the Chinese, you know, occasionally have sort of surged airplanes and fishing fleets, and you end up having sort of a mini crisis. And in the past, it's all receded. But again, given what has happened with Hong Kong, given what has happened with Taiwan, given the Chinese behavior in the South China Sea, the Japanese have to be very concerned that they could be facing down the road a provocation or sort of a turning up of the temperature on something like the Senkakus, which is very important in Japan. And obviously, when you get into those crisis situations, those high tension situations, you really run the risk that things could go sideways in a hurry, even if you are trying to avoid a bad outcome.
Jim, there's a few things that would trigger China more than some sort of Chinese-U.S. statement on Taiwan, but that seems to be something that, according to reports I've seen, the U.S. is urging Prime Minister Suga to do during that meeting. Do you have any sense of whether that's going to happen, whether there's going to be some finessing of that, or, you know, maybe some more broader general statements about importance of you know, regional security and open seas and that type of thing?
Well, as I noted, there's been a lot of talk in the run-up to the summit comment about disagreements between U.S. negotiators and Japanese negotiators over the content of the communique, much of it having to deal with Taiwan. I suspect that language will get worked out. And obviously, people will read the statement once it's issued, arguing about whether it signals a significant movement by Japan or a significant step back by the United States. I think that's just a lot of sort of short-term turmoil. I think the big thing that's clear to the Chinese is that Japan is trying to remain close to the United States. And again, you can understand from the vantage point of Japan why being close to the United States matters. You mentioned Taiwan. The great fear is if Taiwan was reabsorbed back into China, that that would leave Japan even more isolated in East Asia and even more susceptible or vulnerable to Chinese naval pressure. Simply look at the map. And I think that's a situation that the Japanese want to avoid. By the same token, again, the Chinese are pulling whatever levers they can pull to sort of persuade the Japanese not to get too close to the United States. The most recent dust-up has been over a plan by the Japanese government to release, I think it's a couple million gallons of radioactive contaminated water that has been used at the Fukushima power plant. And the release of that radioactive wastewater would be a source of controversy almost at any time. But in the last week or so, the Chinese government has been ramping up its criticism, arguing that Japan should not be using the Pacific Ocean essentially as a sewer for its pollution. So you can see again, you know, the Chinese are playing in the same diplomatic game to try to put pressure on the Japanese, in essence, to get them to back down, to not get too close to the United States. And I think this is our new normal. We're going to go forward with this sort of jockeying and positioning. And again, this is sort of the primary foreign policy objective of the Biden administration, to get people to act in concert, to hopefully not provoke China, but to convince the Chinese to ratchet back many of its behaviors to lower tensions. And we'll see if that strategy both can be enacted and whether it succeeds.
So yet another bit of high-stakes diplomacy early on in the Biden administration.
Well, I think we're going to be seeing a lot of high-stakes diplomacy in the Biden administration, Bob. We're talking about East Asia and China. We're also talking about Iran, which this week announced it's going to go up to 60% enrichment of uranium. And it's a third brewing issue that we're going to talk about now when we switch gears to our audience figure of the week section of the podcast. As you know, listeners can vote on the audience figure of the week or tweet us their suggested figure of the week at CFR_org. And this week, Bob, our audience selected 80,000 plus Russian troops. I think I know why they're flagging this for us, but tell us a bit more.
Yes, Jim. This figure still seems to be the rough estimate of Russian troops that have come from as far as Siberia to be deployed along the Ukrainian border. Reports I've seen say roughly half of that number actually in Crimea, which Russia annexed from Ukraine in 2014. And the others are assembled more closely to the areas of Ukraine that are at this point in dispute, that there's been a secessionist battle going on in these Donbas region locations. And what's concerning is that that number, that we haven't seen this size of Russian deployment since the annexation in 2014. And you're hearing rhetoric from Russia, while on the one hand saying these are routine maneuvers they're doing, you know, the nature of them, the nature of the rhetoric about what they're saying are Ukrainian provocations, Ukrainian aggressiveness, concern about the plight of ethnic Russians in the region. All these things add up to concern that they could be moving towards some sort of more aggressive move, especially in the Donbas region. It came up in a conversation earlier this week between President Biden and President Putin. They talked about a lot of things, but among them was concern about Ukraine. In the U.S., and a quote from the president's office, quote, emphasized the United States' unwavering commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. It was discussed at NATO meetings involving foreign ministers and the U.S. Secretary of State earlier this week as well. There's a great deal of concern about what Russia might be aiming to do in that region and what sort of signals should be sent to dissuade Russia from taking any further steps.
Now, looking at this, Bob, I have to say a lot of the conventional wisdom holds that the Russians won't actually make a move. A lot of this is about intimidation. And the reason they wouldn't do so is that it would inevitably lead to more sanctions. And I should note, just today, the Biden administration announced a new series of sanctions on Russia for the solar winds hack. And now, obviously, the United States has sanctioned pretty much everything you can sanction. But the Russians would worry that it's going to sour relations in Europe and might jeopardize things like the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that is set to go to Germany, which has been the project of love, if I can put it that way, for Chancellor Angela Merkel. But again, if you look at sort of the tumult going on right now in German politics, it's not too hard to imagine that if the Russians were to move into Ukraine, that the forces in Germany that are opposed to Nord Stream 2 will probably come out on top. And that's particularly the Greens, which have emerged as the real counter to the conservatives in Germany, really displacing the Social Democrats. And the Greens have been very critical of Russian foreign policy. But to get back to sort of what the Russians are doing, the fact is that sometimes countries do what the experts say they shouldn't do. I mean, obvious cases, Putin going into Crimea back in 2014. And I know you highlighted the potential for the Russians to go into Donbas region. That's the part of eastern Ukraine where there's been a secessionist movement. Maybe I should put that in air quotes for the last 7 years. But I think a lot of U.S. military planners are really worried about those Russian military deployments to Crimea. Crimea is nowhere near the Donbas. And what they're worried about and what they think the Russians may be interested in doing is potentially launching attacks to gain territory in southern Ukraine on the Black Sea. And in essence, to bar the Ukrainians from having access to the Black Sea, but also to enhance the Black Sea as essentially a Russian lake. Again, don't know whether it's going to happen, but I think that is the concern about where the Russians might be headed if, big if, they decide to move in this current climate.
Yeah, it's important to point that out, Jim. There's a lot of different areas of focus. There's definitely a Russian flex action going on here. But also, not to be counted out, is a move to the Crimea or a Russian ability to respond again to what they think, if they're able to sort of provoke some sort of Ukrainian action, akin to what the Georgians did back in 2008, when they sent forces into a separatist region in South Ossetia. That created a Russian military offensive and a quick plunge into Georgia that was disastrous for the Georgians. And you now have Russians occupying two separatist Georgian regions that make up something like 20% of that country. So the Russians are capable of doing something like this. But apropos the Black Sea, there was some interesting sort of subplot developing this week about whether or not the United States was going to send military ships into the Black Sea. Apparently, they had initially requested permission to pass through the straits overseen by Turkey, and then they apparently withdrew that request. And that all happened after or in and around the time when President Biden talked to President Putin. The other thing that came up during that conversation, by the way, was a U.S. proposal for a summit in a third country between the U.S. and Russian presidents, which the Russians are said to be studying even after the sanctions announcement. So an enormous amount of things going on the U.S.-Russian front. And Ukraine has a potential to be a flashpoint, but I do think it is more of a flex at this point, Jim.
Well, it's certainly the case, Bob, that if the Russians were to move on Ukraine, it is going to put a kibosh on any thinking that might be taking place in the Biden administration about trying to find some way to build a more constructive relationship with the Russians. I know if anybody plays sort of, you know, global grand strategy for beginners, you know, one of the things you would say is, oh, look, the Russians and the Chinese are getting closer. What we should do is try to prevent them from becoming aligned, try to split the Russians off, much the way Henry Kissinger split the Chinese off from the Soviet Union some 50 years ago. But obviously, if we have something happen in Ukraine, that sort of change in policy is not going to happen. And again, what we really don't know is what was said at the nitty-gritty level in that conversation between President Biden and President Putin, whether there really is anything out there where they could sort of slowly, perhaps maybe not even quite openly, sort of walk back from what has become a very hostile relationship. And again, the United States has an interest in trying to turn the flame down on some of these crises, because again, big issues with China, big issues with Iran, big issue with Russia, you know, easier to handle those challenges if they're the only thing you have to worry about. But, you know, as crises multiply, things get more difficult. And you obviously have the possibility that countries see an opportunity to act if you are basically occupied with another crisis. So I think this is actually now a very dangerous time.
And noteworthy that it was the overwhelming choice of our audience, figure of the week choosers. Jim, that's our look at high stakes geopolitics next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Hong Kong democracy activist Jimmy Lai appears in court for sentencing. And And the SpaceX Crew Dragon Endeavor is set to launch to the International Space Station.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.